Today is April 22nd, and we're learning the Torah portions they never told us about. We're in Numbers chapter 22 to 24, which is Parshat Balak, the story of King Balak and the prophet Bilam. Good evening. Welcome back.
Good evening.
Okay. So here we are. You didn't miss anything? Good evening. So let's read for the background, chapter 22. We'll take 2 minutes to talk about the background, and then we'll go right into the material. Chapter 22 of the Book of Numbers, in the JPS English only, it's page 245, and in the Hebrew English, it's page...
If you say 22 of Mishpatim, then it's 159.
No, Mishpatim is Exodus.
Oh, okay. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm in the wrong place completely. Okay.
Well, you're in the JCC.
Okay, then 359.
So, which are the numbers, right?
Chapter 22, the beginning of chapter 22 of the Book of Numbers, just where we left off last time.
Please.
And it says as follows, the first verse. The Israelites then marched on and encamped in the steppes of Moab, across the Jordan from Jericho. Good evening.
Hi.
Back from Israel. Welcome.
Thank you.
Okay. So we're in chapter 22 of the Book of
Page
Numbers.
Page 335.
335 in the Hebrew English of the JPS. Oh, but you have the art scroll.
Yes,
855.
Okay. Thank you.
Which page in the computer?
This page right here. And the people of Israel set forward.
Uh-huh. Okay. But wait a second. That's not your traditional iPad,
it's
right?
It's smaller. Yes, I traded. Actually, this is called the Mini.
Goodness gracious.
It's just smaller.
Balls of fire.
And it's got a little keyboard.
So it's the same thing. It's just smaller.
Same thing, just smaller, lighter, easier to carry around.
Just need better glasses, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So we talked in the past that the Israelites, in chapter 21, the previous chapter, took a number of months to go from basically Kadesh Barnea, which is where they got to in the desert, all the way to the jumping off point from which they will enter the land of Israel in the beginning of the book of Joshua. We're in the beginning of the 40th year in the desert, and they have gone, remember, from the northern Sinai. They've gone south, they've gone all the way to Eilat, basically. They've come around Transjordan, and they've come up now north, following the Jordan Valley, but not directly, not hugging it, but they're quite over east into the desert, because the country, the people of Moab, who live in the what we call the Arava, the Jordan Valley, below the Dead Sea, they're on the they're in the area from the Dead Sea to Eilat. The Israelites are not coming close to there. They're skirting them, going to the east into the desert, and now they've come up to the steppes of Moab across the Jordan from Jericho. And at that point, they turn west to come directly face to face with the Jordan River. That's where they're encamped. So that's where they're going to stay throughout the rest of the book of Numbers and throughout the whole book of Deuteronomy. In other words, nothing happens geographically from this point forward. Let me just put them on the board. I don't have the map that I brought in the past, but if this is something like the Dead Sea, right, then and basically this is all Israel here, and here's the Gulf of Aqaba. This is what we call the valley, right, the Arava. So the Israelites have basically been here, and they've gone, well, let's say they were here, right? And they've gone around, and here they are. Right, again, this is the Dead Sea. This is the valley here. This is what we call today Eilat. Here's Beersheba. And they've come around. They're here. All of this here is Moab. Is Moab. The area here is what's called the area of Sihon, the king of the Amorites, which we saw last time that the Israelites conquered. Goodness gracious!
Hey,
someone I haven't seen for ages. Welcome.
Thank you. Maybe a sheet. Do you have an extra one?
Actually, there's one right over there.
Oh, okay.
But you don't have a text. So we should give you...
He knows it by heart.
No, let's... We won't test you. So we're in chapter 22. Remember, this goes from right to left. Okay, so as I wrote on the sheet, what we have to know also is the territory of the Amorites had earlier belonged to Moab, but had been conquered and wrested from their control. And at one point, this area here, above Jericho, also belonged to Moab, but it was in early generations conquered by the Amorites. And although the Israelites didn't have permission to conquer Moab, they did have permission to conquer the territory of Moab that was presently held by the Amorites. And when they conquered this, they went all the way up to the Bashan, which we said is the Golan. And now they're encamped right over here, waiting to cross over, which will happen in the beginning of the book of Joshua. So let's now, with that background behind us, begin today's material. We're reading a lot of stuff. Hopefully we'll be able to understand something. From the second verse of chapter 22 of the book of Numbers. Balak, son of Zippor, saw all that Israel had done to the Amorites, conquered them. Moab, that's the people that the Israelites did not conquer, but rather skirted them, was alarmed because that people was so numerous. And the Moabites don't know that the Israelites are not going to attack them. They're frightened out of their wits that it might happen. Moab dreaded the Israelites, and Moab said to the elders of Midian, "Now this horde will lick clean all that is about us as an ox licks up the grass of the field." Let me just point out, the Midianites, they're a tribe that apparently live within the borders of Moab. How do I know that? From Genesis, I think it's 35. Let's see on the sheet here. Genesis 36. All right, let's just look for a short moment near the book, the end of the book of Genesis. I'll read one verse there, 36, 35, which says the following. When Husham died, and you don't have to know who that was, Hadad, son of Bedad, who defeated the Midianites in the country of Moab, succeeded him as king. That's the whole thing. The Midianites in the country of Moab. That's all. Just so we know who they are, so where they live.
Zipporah was a Midianite.
Yes, yes.
But a different Midianite.
Well, perhaps not, because if the Midianites are living in the Moabite territory, and here is Egypt, right? It is conceivable, it's certainly conceivable, okay, that Moshe did find his way there. Mm-hmm. It would be a far distance, but given that the Midianites are a nomadic tribe, they don't have their own land, they're generally within Moab, they also could have migrated further south. So, in verse 4b, Balak, son of Zippor, who was the king of Moab at that time, sent messages to Bilam, son of Beor, in Petor, which is by the Euphrates. So now we're in Baghdad already. Right? It's a far distance from Moab to Iraq. They sent messages to Bilam, son of Beor, in Petor, which is by the Euphrates, in the land of his kinfolk, to invite him, saying, "There is a people that came out of Egypt. It hides the earth from view." In other words, they're so numerous. "And is settled next to me. Come then, put a curse upon this people for me, since they are too numerous for me. Perhaps I can thus defeat them and drive them out of the land. For I know that he whom you bless is blessed indeed, and whom you curse is cursed." Says Balak through messengers to this prophet or this sorcerer called Bilam. The elders of Moab and the elders of Midian, versed in divination, set out. So they're traveling through the desert to get to the home of this famous prophet. They came to Bilam and gave him Balak's message. He said to them, "Spend the night here, and I shall reply to you as the Lord may instruct me." By the way, the word "Lord" there is indeed the word that the Hebrew text always uses for God, and not the generic name for God, but the name that the Israelites used for God, the name that was revealed in Revelation, what we say, Yud Kei Vav Kei, the proper name of God. So the Moabite dignitary stayed with Bilam. God, and again, this is the word for God that's used in Jewish texts, it's not a generic name. God came to Bilaam and said, "What do these people want of you?" Bilaam said to God, "Balak, son of Zippor, king of Moab, sent me this message. Here is a people that came out of Egypt and hides the earth from you because they're so numerous, like locusts. Come now and curse them for me. Perhaps I can engage them in battle and drive them off." In other words, the Moabites think that they'll be able to do battle against the Israelites and defeat them if the Israelites have been cursed earlier, if they've been weakened by a curse. But God said to Bilaam, "Do not go with them. You must not curse that people, for they are blessed." Bilaam arose in the morning and said to Balak's dignitaries, "Go back to your own country, for the Lord will not let me go with you." The Moabite dignitaries left, and they came to Balak, right, went through all through the desert, a long journey, and said, "Bilaam refused to come with us." Then Balak sent other dignitaries, more numerous and distinguished than the first. They came to Bilaam and said to him, "Thus says Balak, son of Zippor, please do not refuse to come to me. I will reward you richly, and I will do anything you ask of me. Only come and damn this people for me." Bilaam replied to Balak's officials, "Though Balak were to give me his house full of silver and gold, I could not do anything, big or little, contrary to the command of the Lord my God." He says, "Lord my God," a certain relationship he feels he has with God. "So you too stay here overnight and let me find out what else the Lord may say to me." That night God came to Bilaam and said to him, "If these men have come to invite you, you may go with them. But whatever I command you, that you shall do." When he arose in the morning, Bilaam saddled his ass and departed with the Moabite dignitaries. But God was incensed at his going. So an angel of the Lord placed him in his way as an adversary. He was... I ruined my lesson plan.
That's okay.
Okay, so forget everything I said in the last 30 seconds.
Okay.
What I wanted to do, and I'll do it right now, is to hide something from you. I wanted to chop up the material right in the middle and divide it into two sections and only see the second section later. Which means that you didn't hear me read verse 20. I didn't read it. It doesn't exist.
Okay.
Alright.
Scratch it from the hard disk. Because we're skipping... No, you could have heard me read verse 20, but you didn't hear me read verse 21. That's it. You didn't hear me read verse 21. Didn't read verse 21. Mm-hmm. We're skipping directly from verse 20, okay, all the way to the end of verse 35. You're presently accomplices in having the wool pulled over your eyes. The material we're skipping doesn't exist. We're going right from verse 20 to verse 35b. And verse 35b, I mean the end of verse 35, says, "So Bilaam went on with Balak's dignitaries. When Balak heard that Bilaam was coming, he went out to meet him at Ir Moab, which is on the Arnon border at its furthest point. Balak said to Bilaam, 'When I first sent to invite you, why didn't you come to me? Am I really unable to reward you?' But Bilaam said to Balak, 'And now that I have come to you, have I the power to speak freely? I can only utter the word that God puts into my mouth.' Bilaam went with Balak, and they came to Kiryat Hutzot. Balak sacrificed ox and sheep, and had them served to Bilaam and the dignitaries with him. In the morning, Balak took Bilaam up to Bamot Baal. From there he could see a portion of the people. The people refers to the Israelites, who encamped there, 600,000 men, and additionally women and children. Lots of people. Chapter 23. Unless anyone wants to stop me with something that just wasn't clear. We're going back to this, of course. We just want to get a big picture so we can start talking about the material. Okay.
And how big are does this tribe have?
How many Moabites are there?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Okay.
No idea. Bilaam said to Balak, that's the prophet says to the king, "Build me 7 altars here, and have 7 bulls and 7 rams ready here for me." Balak did as Bilaam directed, and Balak and Bilaam offered up a bull and a ram on each altar. Then Bilaam said to Balak, "Stay here, besides your offerings while I am gone. Perhaps the Lord will grant me a manifestation, and whatever he reveals to me, I will tell you. And he went off alone. He goes to meditate. God manifested himself to Bilam, who said to him, I have set up the seven altars, right? The prophet says to God, I have set up seven altars and offered a bull and a ram on each altar. And the Lord put a word in Bilam's mouth, and he said, return to Balak and speak thus. So he returned to him, so the prophet returns to the king, and found him standing beside his offerings, and all the Moabite dignitaries with him. He took up his theme and said, from Aram has Balak brought me. That's Mesopotamia, that's Baghdad, where he came from. From Aram has Balak brought me, Moab's king from the hills of the east. Come, curse me, Jacob. Come, tell Israel's doom. That's what he asked me to do. How can I damn whom God has not damned? How doom when the Lord is not doomed? As I see them from the mountaintops, gaze on them from the heights, there's a people that dwells apart. Not reckoned among the nations, who can count the dust of Yaakov? Number the dust cloud of Israel. May I die the death of the righteous. May my fate be like theirs. Oh, he did just the opposite of what he was paid to do. Then Balak said to Bilam, what have you done to me? Here I brought you to damn my enemies, and instead you have blessed them? He replied, I can only faithfully repeat what the Lord puts in my mouth. Then Balak said to him, come with me to another place from which you shall see them. You will only see a portion of them. You will not see all of them, and damn them for me from there. With that he took him to Sedet Sofim, on the summit of Pisgah. He built seven altars and offered a bull and a ram on each altar. And Bilam said to Balak, stay here beside your offering while I seek a manifestation yonder. I'm going to go in communion with God. The Lord manifested himself to Bilam and put a word in his mouth, saying, return to Balak and speak thus. He went to him and found him standing beside his offerings and the Moabite dignitaries with him. Balak asked him, what did the Lord say? And he took up his theme and said, up, Balak, attend. Give ear unto me, son of Zippor. God is not man to be capricious or mortal to change his mind. Would he speak and not act? Promise and not fulfill? My message was to bless. When he blesses, I cannot reverse it. No harm is in sight for Yaakov, right? Yaakov is the Israelite people. No woe in view for Israel. The Lord their God is with them, and their kings acclaim in their midst. God who freed them from Egypt is for them like the horns of the wild ox. Lo, there is no augury in Jacob, no divining in Israel. Jacob is told at once, yea, Israel, what God has planned. Lo, a people that rises like a lion, leaps up like the king of beasts, rest not till it's feasted on prey and drunk the blood of the slain. Hinting that they're going to get you. The Israelites are going to attack you. They'll be successful. Thereupon Balak said to Bilam, don't curse them and don't bless them. Just be quiet. In reply, Bilam said to Balak, but I told you, whatever the Lord says, that I must do. Then Balak said to Bilam, come now, I'll take you to another place. Perhaps God will deem it right that you damn them from me there. Balak took Bilam to the peak of Peor, which overlooks the wasteland. Bilam said to Balak, build me here seven altars and have seven bulls and seven rams ready for me here. Balak did as Bilam said. He offered up a bull and a ram on each altar. Now Bilam, seeing that it pleased God to bless Israel, did not, as on previous occasions, go in search of omens, but turned his face towards the wilderness. As Bilam looked up and saw Israel encamped tribe by tribe, the Spirit of God came upon him, taking his theme, he said beautiful things again, wonderful things about the Jewish people. Wonderful, beautiful things that we actually say today as praises of Judaism. Look a little bit at verse 10. Enraged at Bilam, Balak struck his hands together. I called you, Balak said to Bilam, to damn my enemies, and instead you have blessed them these three times. Back with you at once to your own place. I was going to reward you richly, but the Lord has denied you the reward. That's not to say that Balak believes in the Lord, but he's just making fun. Mm-hmm. Bilam said to Balak, but I even told the messenger you sent me. Though Balak were to give me his house full of silver and gold, I could not of my own accord do anything bad or good contrary to the Lord's command. What the Lord says, that I must say. And now, as I go back to my people, let me inform you of what this people will do to your people in days to come. He took up his theme and said, etc., etc., etc. He blesses the Jewish people. And then, verse 25, the whole story ends. Then Bilam set out on his journey back home, and Balak also went his way. That is our synopsis of the story. So now we have to talk about it. So the point that I wanted to make by skipping certain material that you don't even know that we skipped is that when we skip the material that we skipped and we just read the story without that section, what we seem to come face to face with is an almost uniformly positive portrayal of this man, Bilam. He's not Jewish, of course, but he has a reputation as a prophet. And immediately, when you approach him, he says, I can only say what God tells me. And he uses the proper revealed name of God. And again, he says, I accept God's word. I'm going to pass it on faithfully. Doesn't matter what. You pay me all the money in the world, it won't help. I can't change. I'm powerless to take any initiative. It's just what God wants. I'm a servant of God. He wishes to do what God pleases. He does what God pleases. He prophesies just as God said. And even, if you noticed, he prophesies that he himself is blessed by God for obedience. That was, just to remind us, that was in the second prophecy, I believe, if I can find it. Right, he said in verse 9 of 24, Bilam said in 24:9, blessed are they who bless you, talking about the Jews, accursed they who cursed you. Now, since he's blessing, and he's saying, blessed are those who's blessed, he's saying, I'm doing the right thing, and I'm going to be blessed for blessing the Israelite people. So it looks pretty straightforward. It looks pretty good. It doesn't look like there's anything complicated here. And the truth is that there is at least one source in the rest of the Tanakh that does seem to take this approach. Not unequivocally, but plausibly. We're going to look now, as I have in the sheet, at the book of Micha, one of the minor prophets, chapter 6, verse 5. In the Minor Prophets, which is before Psalms, right before Psalms, and it's a very short book. How are we going to find it? It's before Zechariah, and before Haggai, before Tzfanya, before Habakkuk, and before Nahum, and there we are with Micha. Page 1050.
Which chapter of Micah?
Six. It's only 1,050 in the JPS English only. By the way, I don't recommend having the English only, but it's what I have. It's a bad example. You know, I never told you guys this story, why I have this English only Tanakh. I have the, you know, I have this one that Fred is using, the English Hebrew. I never thought I would need just an English Tanakh. I have the English Hebrew. Usually I use the Hebrew. If I give a class, I have the English Hebrew. I had a student who once committed suicide, and I inherited her books. So this is in memory of Diane Levinger. Diane Levinberg. I'll tell you the story some other time. Anyway, chapter 6, verse 5. My people, remember what Balak, king of Moab, plotted against you, and how Bilam, son of Beor, responded to him. The impression you get there is that Balak wanted one thing, a bad thing, but Bilam responded differently, which is what we understood from the verses we read, that Bilam was a good guy and he didn't respond the way that Balak would have wanted him to respond. Fine. That's all in the book of Micha. I want to mention quickly a small number of post-biblical sources that also take this positive approach to the character of Bilam as evidenced in the verses we saw. I'll tell you about... anyone ever heard of Philo? Philo of Alexandria? So Jerry heard of him a little bit. Philo lived in the first century of the Common Era, about the time of the destruction of the Second Temple, and I believe a little bit after the Temple was destroyed in the year 70. He was the leader of the Jewish community of Alexandria, which was one of the big cities in the ancient world. And the Jewish community there was one of the biggest Jewish communities outside of the land of Israel. As leader of the Jewish community, he wrote quite a bit. He wrote tens of books about Judaism, but apparently he didn't know Hebrew. In other words, we have the first example here we know in recorded history of a Jewish community and a Jewish leader that are so, quote-unquote, assimilated, they don't know Hebrew. And the community in Alexandria, though in our terms it's quite close to Israel, right? But in those days, no telephones, no trains. They were far away culturally. They didn't seem to partake of the rabbinic tradition. And their Judaism is in a Greek idiom, you can say. So anyway, Philo has wrote tens of books explaining Judaism to his people and also to Greeks in Greek and using Greek concepts. Today we can learn a lot about the way non-Israel-based Judaism was in the years around the time of the destruction of the temple. Now, Philo being such a major figure, such a prolific writer, we have texts that have been attributed to him, but probably were not written by him. In other words, you want to write some in his name, because then you'll be famous. So anyway, we're going to read from a text, just one line, from what we call Pseudo-Philo. A text that at some point in history was considered to be written by Philo, but scholars have come to the conclusion that it probably was not written by him. It might be what we call pseudo-epigrapha, effort to pass something off as written by a major figure when really it was not. So anyway, on the sheet here in B3A, we have a prayer put into the mouth of Bilam in Pseudo-Philo's retelling of the story. Wherefore, Lord, do you tempt the race of men? I put the quotes there in the wrong place. They therefore cannot sustain it, for you know more than they all that I was, that was in the world before you founded it. And now here's the important point. And now enlighten your servant, if it be right that I go with them. In other words, here's a commentator who is expounding upon the story of Bilam and Balak, and expounding upon it, he's putting a prayer in the mouth of Bilam that shows Bilam's sense of subservience to God, and his sense of obedience to God. In other words, again, this is an effort to portray Bilam as we saw him in a very, very positive fashion from a religious point of view. Another text like that is Agadat Breshit, which is a lesser known rabbinic midrash that says, I cannot undertake to do any evil against Israel, with whom is the Lord? Again, that's put in the mouth by this midrash, put in the mouth of Bilam. And he's saying, I cannot undertake to do any evil against Israel. He uses the word Israel, which we don't find in the text. With whom is the Lord? Now, he is clearly saying that he understands that the Lord is with the Israelites. And then we'll mention another text, Seder Eliyahu Rabba, another rabbinic midrash, that claims that Bilam was greater in wisdom than Moshe. If you remember at the end of the Torah, it says that there has not arisen a prophet among Israel like Moshe. So the Midrash.
Where did Bilam come from?
Where did he come from?
Yeah.
From Saddam Hussein's palace. Remember? From the Euphrates River.
Okay.
You know, but how did he get on the stage? How did he get his level? Nothing. We don't know anything.
I've never heard so much about him before.
Well, we're going to see a lot about him. Very different stuff in another few minutes. So, at the end of the Torah, there's a verse that says, the end of the book of Deuteronomy, there never will arise a prophet among the Jewish people like Moshe. Great thing about Moshe. The Midrash says, what it means is, there'll never be a prophet like Moshe among the Jewish people. But among the Gentiles, there will be. Bilam. So without going into how could he be such a great man? That's what the Midrash claims, and of course that is in accord with the verses we saw until now, that he's very, very obedient, very, very accepting, he only does what God says, he's a prophet, he gets these beautiful prophecies, he's just really, he's up there in the major leagues.
Can I ask you a question? Is this the first time that we see a non-Jew saying, those who bless my people will be blessed, and those who curse my people will be cursed?
That particular type of statement? Yeah, it's the first time.
So he's the first evangelical.
He's the first one. So actually, Jerry is hinting to something, that this stuff about blessing and cursing is actually a hint to a certain chapter earlier in the
Genesis
12. God says, I'll bless those that bless you, to Abraham, and curse them that curse you. Well, here, we're certainly working off of that. Absolutely. Yeah.
To follow that, is this one of the first times now God has moved past the Jewish people to be the God of apparently other people?
Good point.
So,
good question.
And is that followed anywhere else now that he's... Because Balaam represents a big chunk of people over there, right?
Okay, so...
And he's calling them his God as well.
Right, right. So first of all, the whole picture will change another 5 minutes. But until the picture changes, let's work with what you're bringing up. So, first of all, of course, we've seen relationships between God and people who aren't Jewish before Abraham, before there are Jews. That's a given, right? We have the first man and woman, Adam and Eve. We have Noah, but that's before Abraham comes on the scene. But once Abraham comes on the scene, do we have God talking to any other individuals? In the book of Genesis, God talks to Laban, right, the father-in-law of Jacob, when he's pursuing Jacob ostensibly to do him harm, and God says, don't do him harm. And secondly, we have God talking to Avimelech, the king of Gerar, saying, don't do harm to Sarah, who you took into your harem, if you remember that story. Those are the only three places in the Torah in which we have God talking to a non-Jew.
What about Hagar?
Oh, okay, so that's an angel. That's an angel, but you know, you're right. I was thinking of a place where it directly says God's name, Yud-Kei Vav-Kei. But you're right, often angels are interchangeable with God, at least in Genesis, and that's true, so there's a fourth case.
But he's talking to them, representing, in essence, the Jews and being protector on behalf of the Jews. This seems to imply that he's also like their God or something else, so it's a... much
yeah.
fuller relationship than the example.
Right. Well, here, of course, here also, God is talking to Balaam only to protect the Jewish people. But there is an inference that there's
right.
been a pre-existing
right.
relationship
right.
between God and this prophet.
Right.
right. So that's, in that sense, that's, you have the case of Malki Tzedek. The king of Shalem in the time of Abraham, right? Abraham, if you remember, helps out the captured city of Sodom. All their men and their booty are taken captive, most of them. And Abraham musters an army, brings the men and the booty back, and then this Malki Tzedek comes out and meets Abraham and blesses Abraham in the name of the Most High God. And so there's another example. And rabbinic literature talks about, and later non-rabbinic literature talks about who was this figure, this great righteous figure of Malki Tzedek. Another thing we might mention in the context of what Fred brought up is the book of Jonah, in which God doesn't talk directly to the Gentiles, but he talks to the Jew, Jonah, for the sake of the Gentile city, to go as a prophet to the Gentile city and tell them to stop sinning or else I'm going to zap them, says God. And indeed, they stop sinning and God doesn't zap them. That was a prophecy for the sake of the Gentile nations. But more or less, besides those examples, this is a very, very Judeo-centric text. Yeah. Okay, so we don't have to look at B3D. That's another rabbinic midrash that points out the greatness of Balaam. The point that I would make is that the texts that we've just seen that point out the greatness of Balaam and the righteousness of Balaam and how he's so close to God, those texts are an absolute minority in Jewish literature. Most of the texts come down on them hard and talk about him as a rasha, as an evil man, as a villain, as a criminal, as someone who is distant from God. And where does that come from? We saw such beautiful verses that we read again and again and again and again. So what I want to do is go back to the verses in the Torah that I hid from you and read them. What we're going to see is the following. Let me be honest. Let me be honest about this. We're going to see one of the many sources that biblical critics use to prove that the Torah has to be a combination of documents written by different authors with different viewpoints. Just like I've mentioned a number of times, or perhaps I haven't, but I probably did, that you read Genesis chapter 1, then you read Genesis chapter 2 and 3, and you say, wait a second, there are two different creation stories with two different points of view and two different messages about the relationship of God and man and woman and man to the animals, a completely different story. Something very similar here. We read, until now, one aspect of the Bilam and Balak story, but the verses that I hid from you seem to give a totally different approach. And you might think that the simplest way to understand how do these two different sets of verses jive, the answer you might give is they don't jive. Two different stories here, two different perspectives of who this man was. That's not my personal conclusion, but it would seem that way on the face of things. So here we're going back to the verses we skipped. And the verses we skipped are in chapter 22. Chapter 22, verse 21. So you remember what happened? The messengers come to Bilam, they say, come with me to Balak to curse the Israelite people. And he says, no, I can only do what God says. And I'm not going with you because he told me not to come. So the messengers go home and they come back, more messengers, and they promise great things to him if he comes and curses the Israelite people. And he says, look, God said I can't, but I'll ask him again. And he asked God again, and God said, you know what? If you want to go, you can go. That's what we read until now. And now chapter 22, verse 21, beginning of the verses we skipped previously. When he arose in the morning, after God telling him he could go, Balaam saddled his ass and departed with the Moabite dignitaries. But God was incensed at his going. So an angel of the Lord placed himself in his way as an adversary. It's very strange. God just said you can go, and he goes, and God gets incensed. He was riding on his she-ass with two servants alongside when the ass caught sight of the angel of the Lord standing in the way with his drawn sword in his hand. So this angel is going to kill the donkey and kill Bilam if he goes further on the path to meet Balak. The ass swerved from the road and went into the fields, and Bilam beat the ass to turn her back onto the road. The angel of the Lord then stationed himself in a lane between the vineyards with a fence on either side. The ass, seeing the angel of the Lord, pressed herself against the wall and squeezed Bilam's foot against the wall, so he beat her again. Once more, third time, the angel of the Lord moved forward and stationed himself on a spot so narrow that there was no room to swerve right or left. When the ass now saw the angel of the Lord, she lay down under Bilam. There's a word for that in Hebrew. They're boats. It just, you know, it crouched down. It couldn't go anywhere. And Bilam was furious and beat the ass with his stick. Then the Lord opened the ass's mouth, and she said to Bilam, what have I done to you that you have beaten me this three times? Bilam said to the ass, you have made a mockery of me. If I had a sword with me, I'd kill you. The ass said to Bilam, look, I am the ass that you have been riding along all the time until this day. Have I been in the habit of doing thus to you? And he answered, no. Then the Lord uncovered Bilam's eyes, and he saw the angel of the Lord standing in the way, his drawn sword in his hand. Thereupon he bowed right down to the ground. The angel of the Lord said to him, why have you beaten your ass these three times? It is I who came out as an adversary, for the errand is obnoxious to me. And when the ass saw me, she shied away because of me these three times. If she had not shied away from me, you are the one I should have killed while sparing her. Bilam said to the angel of the Lord, I erred because I did not know that you were standing in my way. If you still disapprove, I will turn back. But the angel of the Lord said to Bilam, go with the men, but you must say nothing except what I tell you. Stop. And it looks like two different stories. First, we had a story of this good, obedient, subservient to God man who's always mentioning God, always wants to do God's will, goes neither to the left or the right except when he's told by God. And on the other hand, we have this guy who gets God incensed by going where he's going. And then this story that portrays Bilam as stupider than an ass. Right? Did you see? That's the purpose of the story. To compare him to an ass. The ass sees God or the angel. He doesn't see. The ass is very polite. He is ungrateful. Everything is wrong with him. Whereas everything is right with the ass. Those story is to lampoon him, to make a fool of him, and to tell us that when he does go and prophesies, all he is a talking donkey. Let me just go through some of the points that I wrote on the sheet to make it even clearer. So I wrote there in C2A, the very bottom of the piece of paper, that Bilam, who desires to subdue Israel with words, cannot even subdue his ass with a stick. Mm-hmm. Right? Number two, or B, Bilam, who claims prophetic insight, cannot see what his ass sees three times. C, Bilam, who claims prophetic speech since the Lord puts words in his mouth, is now matched by his ass. D, Bilam, who boasts that his knowledge is from the Most High, has to admit, I don't know. That he said, I didn't know, I didn't see, I had no idea. Bilam, who is the wise of the wise, is bested in a verbal exchange with the most stupid of beasts. F, Bilam, who wishes to slay a whole people with his words, can only kill his ass with a sword. And G, Bilam, who would slay his ass if only had a sword, does not see the sword extended by the angel. In short, he's portrayed as a fool, as stupider than an ass, as really dumb, doesn't know how to control himself, can't see what an ass can see, so he's really, like I said, no better than a talking donkey. And in addition to all that, this whole thing contradicts, really contradicts, not just the way it portrays the personality of the man, contradicts everything else, but also contradicts the previous material in the following sense. The previous material said that God said he should go. This material said God angry. God got angry when he went and tries to stop him. But then contradicts himself, the material contradicts itself, that it does let him go in the end. We have a problem. We have a problem. Now, it gets worse, because there's additional verses in the Torah that talk about Bilam, and they're universally pejorative. In other words, they fit with this section about the ass, and they don't fit with the other sections that we saw. Let's just read through those verses. Numbers chapter 31. Numbers chapter 31, verse 7. Numbers chapter 31, verse 7. In the English only, it's on page 261. It's talking about the Israelite army. They took the field against Midian, right? Those are the tribes we're dealing with right now. As the Lord had commanded Moses, and slew every male. Along with their other victims, they slew the kings of Midian, Evi and Rechem and Sur and Hor and Reva, the five kings of Midian. They also put Bilam, son of Beor, to the sword. They considered him to be a criminal. And just look a few verses forward, the explanation of why they consider him to be a criminal, verse 15 in the same chapter, right? This is chapter 31, verse 15. Moshe said to them, said to the returning soldiers, you have spared every female, yet they're the very ones with the bidding of Bilam induced the Israelites to trespass against the Lord in the manner of Peor, so that the Lord's community was struck by a plague. That's an event we didn't talk about yet, in which the Israelites are seduced or attacked by the Midianites. And here, the verse attributes the seductive attack, which again we didn't see, to the bidding of Bilam. As if he couldn't curse them, he tried to get them in a different way. That's pretty explicit that he's not a good guy. As opposed to the impression we got from so many other verses that he's a Great guy. Okay, a little bit more. It gets worse. It gets more contradictory. Look at Deuteronomy chapter 13. It's 23. Deuteronomy 23, verse 5. Which talks about the Moabites, and it says, because they did not meet you with food and water on your journey after you left Egypt, and because they hired Balaam son of Beor from Patur of Aram Naharaim to curse you, but the Lord your God refused to heed Balaam. Instead, the Lord your God turned the curse into a blessing for you. The Lord your God loves you. So the impression you get very clearly is that Balaam tried and wanted to curse you, but God didn't let him. Right? That's different than the impression we got from certain verses, that he didn't want to curse. He just wanted to do what God said. So these verses in Deuteronomy that said he wanted a curse but didn't succeed, they are in accord with the verses about the donkey, which portray him as a fool and an idiot and an evil man. Right? So the looks, again and again, I'm saying the same thing for the past 15 minutes, there seem to be two different portrayals of the same man, one very negative and one very positive. Okay. Should I keep rubbing it in? I don't know. Yes.
Joshua.
You're looking, okay, you can't restrain yourself.
Okay, I don't want to divert you too much, but I want to ask something from an ethics point of view. Is there any verses in the Bible where these kings said, let me send an emissary out and make peace with the Jewish people, and let us all live together in harmony, and let us not slay each other, and let us, and actually try to make peace or something positive with regard to that? Or were the Jews sent emissaries?
There is, said? Actually. We did it last week. You missed it.
Okay.
The nations in this area that the Israelites conquer, it says that Moses sent emissaries saying, I'm sorry, no, it wasn't here, it was here. Let us pass through your land. And they said no. And they came out with armies against the Israelites. So Israel had to go around instead of going through. That happened with Moab, it happened with Edom. There are such things. Of course, Fred, I understand what's bothering you, and it bothers me also. We can't talk about everything every time, but I understand. I'm not...
But we all have our themes. This is my theme.
Yeah.
Why can't he convert the people or become the God of everybody or make it more positive? Why is it... This strategy doesn't seem to be a God strategy, it seems to be,
I understand. I really do.
Well, is there any discussion on that in terms
of... Oh, of course there's discussion. There's quite a bit of discussion. Torah Shel Peh, right, the rabbinic tradition, does an awful lot, I would say, to ameliorate the violence. Just to give you very short examples, right? The Torah says an eye for an eye, and we know that the rabbinic tradition says it means the worth of an eye, it means monetary compensation. That's just one example. Another example is that whereas the book of Joshua tells us that Moses went in and killed the males and the males of all these nations and took the women captive, the rabbinic tradition says that he gave them a chance to make peace, etc., 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 and he only captured and killed those who didn't want to make peace. And it's a whole big story. But yes, I understand. Yeah. So Morris is already looking in the book of Joshua. Perhaps we will... okay, you want to look in Joshua? Look. Okay.
I was just curious.
Yeah, Joshua 13, verse 21. Joshua 13, verse 21, again, has bad things to say about this Balaam guy. 13:21. all the towns of the Tableland and the entire kingdom of Sihon, the king of the Amorites, who had reigned in Cheshbon. For Moses defeated him, and the Midianite chiefs, Evi, Rechem, Tzur, Hor, and Reba, who had dwelt in the land as prince of Sihon, together with the others that they slew, the Israelites put Bilam, son of Beor, the augur, to the sword. He's called an augur, and he's called a diviner, which is not a positive way of looking at him in the terms of the Torah. Okay. In post-biblical tradition, besides those three rare midrashim we saw that have positive things to say at Bilam, the vast majority of the material has very negative things to say about him. Now, it's learning from the part of the chapter that talked about the donkey, that he was evil in the core. Philo talks about it. Josephus talks about it. There's sources in the New Testament that I mentioned here that talk about it. And then there's Ethics of the Fathers, Tractate of Vote, that says he is the epitome of evil. And he's an example of someone who's going to hell. He's in bad shape. You don't have to read all the sources. You can look at them later. Okay, finally we're ready to begin the class. That's the background. What do we do? What do we do? So, like I said earlier, biblical criticism has an answer, which is to say that these are separate texts that were put together and they represent the differing traditions. Okay? And I certainly am not here to prove that wrong. I don't have any proofs, but I want to show the direction that rabbinic tradition went in understanding this. And instead of reading rabbinic sources to begin with, we'll read them later, I want us to go back to the verses ourselves and try and ferret out the hints, the allusions that the rabbis picked up on in order to reconcile these seemingly two different directions. So whenever you have two seemingly different directions and you want to reconcile them, you either read A in light of B or B in light of A. Right? There are no other possibilities if you want to come to some type of unified theory. So what the rabbis did is to read the good verses in light of the bad verses. Right? The verses about the donkey that portray him as an idiot and a fool and a terribly wicked man, they find hints of that wickedness even in the verses that appear to present him in a positive light. And I want to go through those verses that appear to present him in a positive light and see if we can ferret out those same hints that our rabbis worked with. So that means we're going back to the book of Numbers, chapter 22, and we're going to read chapter 22 of the book of Numbers. So you remember the first few verses that Balak, the king of Moab, sends to Baghdad to bring this man Bilam to curse the Israelite people. And we'll pick up the story in verse 6. Come then, say the messengers, put a curse upon this people for me, since they are too numerous for me. Perhaps I can thus defeat them and drive them out of the land. For I know that he whom you bless is blessed indeed, and he who you curse is cursed. The elders of Moab and the elders of Midian, versed in divination, set out. They came to Bilam and gave him Balak's message. He said to them, spend the night here, and I shall reply to you as the Lord may instruct me. There is something in that verse that could give an indication that there's something wrong with Bilam. I'm not saying I would have seen it had I just approached this verse cold, but knowing what I do at what comes later about the incident with the donkey, how he seems so anti-God, seems such a rebel, what might I see here in verse 8?
He time to figure out what he's going to say.
Yeah. I mean, remember the following. The Israelites left Egypt with big miracles, according to the text's own understanding. And about 50 days later, after they left Egypt, with the plagues and the splitting of the Red Sea, they come to Mount Sinai, and there's a big revelation, and there's fire and lightning. And remember then Yitro, Moses' father-in-law, comes and says, I heard all that God did. I heard about it. In other words, it was on the front page of all the newspapers. And also remember that at the Red Sea, not going in order here, at the Reed Sea, when the sea split and the Israelites sang their song, one of the things they say is, we know that the nations of Canaan are trembling. They see how God is with us. And they know. And also remember that at the beginning of the book of Joshua, when the Israelites come to attack Jericho, to go across the river, which is only a few months after this material is taking place, we have the prostitute of Jericho, Rahab, who says, all my countrymen are quaking in their boots. They know what God did for you, and they know that God is with you. So if it's on the front pages of the newspapers, and this man is a prophet, what does he need time to think? If he's told, I want you to come with me and curse the Israelites, he has to think about it. I mean, what do you mean? He doesn't read the papers? Even if he doesn't read the paper, he's a prophet. He's supposed to be a prophet. He should know that these people are cursed. Sorry. These people are blessed.
I can read it a much different way. I could say he knows he's going to turn them down, so he wants to have the authority of God and not just him, because he knows he's going to have to disappoint him big time. And yeah. I will reference you. It seems like Moses did it all the time. I'll go to the tent tonight. I'll go in. I'll talk to God. I'll come back. I'll tell you what he thinks. So it's no different than a lot of the way Moses operated.
Yeah. I admit that you could be right. I'm not trying to read these verses in a vacuum. I'm trying to read them in light of the material about the donkey. Since I know that there's something wrong with the guy, he's not totally righteous, can I find any hint of that in the verses that do seem to portray him as righteous? So the answer is I can find a hint of his evil nature. You're right, it's not the way I might have read it had I had the verse in a vacuum, but it's possible to read the verse like that, because we're trying to create a unified theory. I just wanted to show the unified theory is possible, not that it's necessary. Right? That's what I think. It's possible. It's possible. Okay, so the Moabite dignitary stayed with Bilam. And then it says, God came to Bilam and said, what do these people want of you? Bilam said to God, Balak son of Zippor, king of Moab, sent me this message. Here is a people that came out from Egypt and hides the earth from you. Come now and curse them for me. Perhaps I shall engage them in battle and drive them off. But God said to Bilam, do not go with them. You must not curse that people, for they are blessed. So, on the face of it, there's nothing wrong here. It all looks good. Except that God opens up his words to Bilam with a question. What do these people want of you? Now, God knows the answer. Of course he knows the answer. But nevertheless, God asks him to tell the story. So God apparently wants to get into a conversation with Bilam. Then we ask ourselves, is there any place earlier in the Torah in which God asks a question of someone in a context where God knows the answer, but he just wants to get into a conversation?
Adam.
And the context is that Adam... What did Adam do?
Ate the forbidden fruit.
Yeah. In other words, again, and Fred, what I'm saying now is not a proof. It's a possible way of reading it. That we know from earlier experience that after a man sins, God sometimes comes and gives him an opportunity to talk, hoping that the man will repent. Could be the same thing here. God said to Bilam, what do these people want of you? And God perhaps is hoping that he'll say, they want me to curse the Jewish people. I know I shouldn't be doing it, but Fred said that I should just, you know, I should ask you so it looks better. But that's not what he says. He just says they want me to curse. And he gives no hint that he understands that there's anything wrong with it. He gives no hint that he understands that there's anything wrong with it, even though he's given opportunity to engage in the conversation. So again, this is not a proof, but it's a possibility. that already here we see a second time there's something a little bit problematic in the behavior, perhaps, of this man, Bilam. Let's go on. Bilam arose in the morning and said to Balak's dignitaries, "Go back to your own country, for the Lord will not let me go with you." Anything wrong with that?
It's not the truth.
It's not the truth. Okay, so what's the truth? I didn't say you're wrong. I didn't say you're right. You're right. But so what's the truth? What's the full truth? What's the full truth? Just read in the previous verse. What did God actually say to him? Right, there's a difference between what God says to him on the one hand and what he relates to the dignitaries that want him to go. That God says to him, "Do not go with them. You must not curse that people, for they are blessed." Whereas, when he wakes up in the morning, all he says to the dignitaries is, "Go back to your own country. The Lord will not let me go with you." He makes it sound arbitrary. Whereas the truth is, God said the people are blessed. Why doesn't he say that the people are blessed? Obviously, because he's embarrassed to say they're blessed when he really wants to curse them. That's plausible. Why does he not say the people are blessed? Perhaps he doesn't. I can be a little bit less pejorative. He just doesn't have the backbone to say the truth. Right? Which is, despite the fact that you guys want me to curse them, the truth is, not only won't let me do it, but God has blessed them. He doesn't say it. To me, that's a pretty strong hint. I wouldn't say a proof, but it's a strong hint that there's something fishy going on here. But we're not finished. So, the Moabite dignitaries left and they came to Balak and said, Bilam refused to come with us. Then Balak sent other dignitaries, more numerous and distinguished than the first. So why does he send dignitaries more numerous and distinguished than the first? Because he wants to honor Bilam. But then the question arises, why does he think that honoring Bilam will get the guy to change his mind? And then we go back to the previous point. If Bilam had said clearly, "God has blessed this people, I can't curse them," then the king Balak would have known that no amount of greater dignitaries would help change his mind. But since he didn't give that reason, he only said, "God won't let me go." So the implication is, God won't let me go, but if you honor me more, perhaps God will let me go. Again, it's not a proof, but it's a way to see this story in a different light, a plausible light, that allows us to create an organic whole with the part of the story that seems to be very different. And that's the way, more or less, the rabbinic tradition read it. And it looks to me like there's something to it. There's something to it, a little bit more even. If we go further, so we got to verse 16. They came to Bilam and said to him, "Thus says Balak, son of Zippor, please do not refuse to come to me. I'll reward you richly. I will do anything you ask of me. Only come and damn this people for me." Balak replied to Balak's officials, "Though Balak were to give me his house full of silver and gold, I could not do anything big or little contrary to the command of the Lord my God." So that verse, you can read in two different ways. You can read it at face value. You could read it as a hint. All the silver and gold in the world. A hint, if you give me enough money, perhaps it'll work. Again, am I certain that's the way to read it? Of course not. But it's possible.
See, I read it completely different. I would say that this shows that Balak doesn't understand the power of God.
Right.
He thinks that Balaam is only making the decision himself as a man.
Right. Right.
And that God is not behind him.
Right.
And therefore,
right.
He's blind to the power of God and keeps trying like this and keeps going down this path, even getting him there and failing and failing and failing, and never understands that God is behind the thing. So
yeah.
That's one of the morals I would get out
right.
of the story.
And you're right. I mean, that part of it is certainly true. That's true. But is Bilam making enough of an effort to completely and absolutely contradict that approach?
Well, others may have a different opinion, but I think you've made a pretty weak case on this one in terms of Bilam so far with regard to these chapters.
Well, what about, let me try again. Fred, let me try again.
Maybe someone else feels differently about it. I think straws are being grasped here so far.
You know, but I also agree with you.
Okay.
This is absolutely an effort to maintain the integrity of the story. It's an effort that we wouldn't make had we not had that insertion about the donkey. I agree with you. But if we have to make the effort, then I think there's something to it. Again, I go back to one point I made. Why didn't Bilam say to the messengers that God said his people is blessed? He really did leave that out. He really did.
But he did say, God said, I can't curse you.
Yes, you're right.
Okay,
yes, you're
so
right.
That's a pretty good answer. God said it. I mean, you go back, hey, God said to the guy he can't do it. So
I hear.
Most people would say, okay, I'm stymied on that one.
It's hard for me to argue with you because I'm also on your side.
Okay.
I'm on both sides. Okay. So, we're reading verse 18. We read 18, 19. But let's read 18 again. Bilam replied to Balak's officials, though Balak were to give me his house full of silver and gold, I could not do anything big or little contrary to the command of the Lord my God. Okay. So why doesn't he say goodbye? But instead he says, so you too stay here overnight, and let me find out what else the Lord may say to me. What do you mean? You know that God has blessed this people. You know he said you can't curse them. You know he said don't go with them. You know God has a plan to bring them into the land of Canaan. No? What's going on? Why do you have to say, stay here overnight, I'll try again? Some of the historical critical commentators point out that in divination in the ancient Middle East, the diviners tried and tried again until they got the right answer from the gods that they wanted. Right? If it was a matter of throwing an arrow at a certain tree, and if the arrow landed a certain place, it meant X, a certain place it meant Y, so you threw the arrow until you got it to give you the right answer. He's grasping at straws now, right? He's trying to get a different answer.
But if your point is right, why did God come back to him and say something more? Why didn't God just say, just never answer?
Good question.
Again? I mean,
good question.
That's the point you're trying to make, and God contradicts it.
So let's read and deal with it. So you two stay here overnight. Let me find out what else the Lord may say to me. That night, God came to Bilam and said to him, if these men have come to invite you, you may go with them. But whatever I command you, that you shall do. Okay, so now God has contradicted himself. God seems to have changed his mind. How do we get our head around that? Any suggestions? It's a problem. It really is. Testing him. That's possible, right? You can go, but whatever I command you, that you shall do. It's going to put Bilam in a difficult situation. He's going to really go into the lion's den right next to Balak, and he's going to have to bless when he's wanted to curse, which in the end he does. It certainly makes life difficult for him. It would be easier to stay at home. So that's possible. That's certainly possible.
But you can also say he actually anticipated the fact that God may have a further or additional response to him, which in fact happened, which would be...
It happened...
Well, you were cutting it off in the sentence before this happened.
Right, it should have been cut off.
Right.
So I'll tell you what Rashi says, which we'll see. No, actually, we won't. What Rashi says, that God is leading him in the path he wants to go. God said, "Don't go," and he keeps banging on the door. God, please let me go. Please let me go. Okay, go, but it's going to get you killed. In the end, he gets killed for going. He becomes an accomplice to the Midianites, as we saw. In the end, he's killed.
Couldn't you also say that in some degree this is an affirmation of the fact that man has free will, and that he has the free will. God then stops him, not by stopping him himself, but by preventing him from going any further by manipulating his ass.
I'm not sure why you see free will here.
Because God is saying to him, if you want to go with them, go ahead. But ultimately, you're going to have to do what I want you to do. So he gets up in the morning and he thinks he's going to go with them. He's blocked.
I understand, but he could have gotten up to go with them even if God said no. But God didn't have to say yes. He could have just disobeyed God because he has free will. Right? The fact that he's told that he can go, that doesn't prove anything about free will, that particular line. Because again, he could have gotten up to go even if God said no. That would have proven free will, right? If God said no, but he got up to go anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So in that particular line, I don't see a proof for free will.
Well, couldn't you also say that God, he knows that God said these people are blessed. So therefore, and God said, you'll only speak the words I tell you. So he knows he's going out there to bless them. You can say that.
Or else he thinks he's going to manipulate God. Right? Because God said, don't go the first time. But he asked the second time. God gave in. So he thinks, if I try and I push and I knock on the door enough, God's going to change his mind.
But as far as the facts are, God said the people are blessed. And God said, you can go, but only speak the words I tell you. So the logic would be that I'm going to go out there and bless the people. I'm going to bless him.
But then why does he go? Because you have to think, because he really wants to bless them. He really wants to do the blessing.
Because God said, if the men come, rise up and go with them. But speak the words that I shall give you. So he's saying, now I've changed my mind a little bit, go out and bless them.
And you're saying that Bilaam is very happy with that. That's what you're saying?
The logic would say, from the facts he's got so far, if he is going, he is going to bless him, as far as what Bilaam knows. That's what this, to me, would say.
Okay, I think it's possible to read it differently. Possible to read it differently. I really do.
I don't think Bilaam had control of what he was going to say.
Yeah, but the question is, what does Bilaam think now? Does he think he's going to be able to curse, or does he think he's going to bless? What does he think at this point? Fred says he thinks he's going to bless, and he's happy with that. I'm saying it's possible to read it that he actually thinks he's going to be able to curse. He's hoping he'll be able
that's
to curse.
Okay. Yes, that's my point. You made my point.
What did you say? I made your point?
You
meaning?
Made my point. I don't think. I agree. I don't think he's convinced. He's not. I think the way you're sort of reading it, it doesn't sound like he's enthusiastically going out to bless them, to say, you know what, I'm going to. People are blessed. It's almost as though he is having an internal strife within himself, moral dilemma within himself, what he's going
to
do.
Mm-hmm. Well, then, to follow up what you're saying, if you jump to 31, it says, then the Lord uncovered Balaam's eyes.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that means that suddenly there's some kind of a revelation after all of the battle that's gone on.
You don't have to read it like you're reading, but you could, because it could just be uncovered his eyes so he can see the angel. But you're reading it more generally.
Yes.
I don't know.
I just think it's possible that Bilaam is foolish to go to Balak and bless the Israelites. I would be afraid.
Yes.
Maybe he's got some spiritual something going on that makes him.
Okay, so that's Fred's way of reading it. That would be Fred's way of reading it. Whereas I'm suggesting that he really thinks he's going to be able to get God to change his mind the second time. He changed his mind the first time, he can change his mind the second time.
Well, I'd read it a little. If you want to put a sinister thing here, the only thing I would say is he comes in person to Balak. He sees the word of God says, I got to bless them, they're a blessed people. And maybe Bilaam gives him the silver anyway. So, because he's offering silver for all this, so now he's in person with the guy, he sees it's still the word of God, maybe he says, well, you came out there and did all this and did that. That could be slightly sinister, but not the other thing. I think the other thing, as far as he knows, he's going to have to bless him at this point.
I hear.
You know, one of the things with that notion of negotiating and arguing with God. Three times, it's like, don't go. And then God says, okay, go. But it's this tension, this, why can't I get it the first time? But this, you see that theme throughout, this arguing with God. This, and so I don't think, I mean, because he's arguing with God, I sort of see that he is disingenuous. That's the way I read it. Now, I can understand he's going to follow what God asked him. But it took a lot of, he didn't do it on the first time. It took three times.
Yeah.
And even God got incensed, which is a strong word.
Right. God got incensed that he was going. The implication is that he shouldn't have gone. Ah, God said to go, but God said to go. I'm suggesting only because Balaam basically forced God's hand. If you want to go, okay, go. But I don't want you to go, but if you want to go, go.
But what, and one difference more in his defense is, a lot of times the arguing is the same variable, meaning like with Abraham, it was the city was there and then he was arguing. But here the guys came back. See, it's a second thing. He told them no, and they left, and he left it alone. He didn't talk to God about it once they left. Now they came back, and all he did was, okay, they've come back, I want to do this. He talked to God
again.
After they came back. Different circumstance, which would somewhat justify a second conversation. There was a new variable, whereas with Abraham, there was no variable difference.
I don't know why it would justify a second conversation. God already said no. No is no.
Okay,
again, I see both sides. And the truth is I took Fred's side for many years of my life. I want to do a little more here. At the end of the story of the donkey, we have verse 34. In the end of the story of the donkey. Chapter 22, verse 34. Now, in the story of the donkey, the angel, remember, has a sword, stopping the donkey from moving forward. Clearly, the angel is trying to stop Balaam from going where he's going. But Balaam doesn't see. And then his eyes are opened up and he sees that the angel has been preventing the donkey from moving forward. And verse 34 says, Balaam said to the angel of the Lord, I erred because I did not know that you were standing in my way. If you still disapprove, I will turn back. What he should say is, I see you disapprove, I'm turning back. What's this? If I mean, I know it's on tape, but I'm going to say it anyway. I see myself in this, arguing with my wife. She said no, but I said, well, if you disapprove... It's so clear. The angel disapproves. God disapproves. The angel has a sword. It's standing in the way. If you disapprove, I'll turn back.
That's why I think it's disingenuous.
Yeah, absolutely.
Then the angel says, go ahead.
Because I told you not to go. And you say, if you told me not to go, say, go already and get yourself killed. Which is what happens.
But God up here in 20 says, if the men come to call, rise up and go with them. So
right.
God's told him to do that.
But it was the same if, whereas Balaam should have understood that he was told already, no.
Well, all God had to do was say in 20, if they come, don't go with them. Then it's over. And he's done with
God is like my wife. She's fed up with me talking back again and again and again. By the way, I'm talking about my previous years. I hope I've matured a little bit since then. So
I see what you're saying, though. And that's why people have been talking about it for 1,000 years.
Yeah.
It just really doesn't.
Right. I see what you're saying also.
Well, there's another issue that maybe you can comment on, which is that I think you're making him worse off with the donkey story because he doesn't see. So now, is there sort of a issue, the fact that this man doesn't see because he is really, that it's there to see, but he doesn't have the ability to see? Or if you read the story as it is, he didn't see and only the donkey saw. So is there an issue, the fact that he didn't see imputes his awareness of the world, sort of a metaphorical thing that is being shown here
that he doesn't
see.
Should
have been able to see, that the rabbis would say he should have been able to see, because it because there's a line in there that the angel made himself visible to him, which implies that he was invisible to him.
Right, yeah.
So therefore, he wouldn't have all the fault you're implying in the donkey story, if you ask me, because the angel is purposely making himself invisible.
I understand.
So that troubles me, that one sentence troubles me.
But the idea is to show that here's a prophet who doesn't see. So what type of a prophet is he? I understand that the angel made him not see, but it's in order to portray him as a person that doesn't see. What type of prophet is that doesn't see? Again, to lapoon him. Okay, that's basically my presentation. I didn't mean to prove anything to you. I did mean to make it clear that the biblical interpretation is so many faceted and is so complicated because the basic building blocks are problematic. They really are. It's not like there are two different interpretations because one interpretation missed something. No, both interpretations are based on reading the verses, but the verses are contradictory.
But I think if you go down to the very end, to 38.
To 38.
Balaam said to Balak, "And now that I have come to you, and and have the power to do, I have the power to, I can only utter the word that God puts into my mouth." So, which goes back to what I was saying before, is like the whole issue, did he ever have free will?
So he has free will to go or not go.
Yeah, but he understands now that he really never had a choice of what was going to be said because God put the words in his mouth.
Right, as far as a prophet, a prophet can only prophesize what's given him.
But he didn't understand that all along, apparently.
No, he had free will to decide that he would speak the words that God told him.
You know, I could make some crazy argument that, in fact, that God was able to actually control his mouth to say what he wanted to say. I know that's sort of far-fetched, but he did it with the ass. He opened his mouth. Why can't he open a human's mouth and do the same thing?
Well,
it's not far out.
The question: have I not the power to speak freely? That's right. Exactly.
And I'm just saying, you know, if God can have an ass speak, why can't he have a human speak?
Yeah.
It's the Mr. Ed theory, I guess.
You're dating yourself, but that's okay. Right. I'm with you.
But I was curious about Balaam, what his reputation was. We don't know. But
beforehand. Right.
Has God ever done that in any of these stories?
Done?
Made a person speak? Always been free will. Demonstrated.
Well, this gets us into what is prophecy? And obviously, there's no simple answer to that. I'll just tell you what the rabbinic tradition says about that as we close the class. The rabbinic tradition that sees this character so pejoratively says that he wasn't a prophet, he was a talking donkey. What's the difference? A prophet is someone, and again, there's a certain worldview behind this that's not in the Torah, but it's in later Jewish sources. A prophet is someone who's on the intellectual and moral level so that his psyche becomes so in line with God's psyche that he wants to speak, and he speaks of his free will what God wants him to speak. And most human beings don't get to that level because they're not mature enough emotionally and intellectually. But on the other hand, Balaam, he wasn't a prophet. He was just a talking donkey. God opened his mouth and the words came out. But it's not like it was filtered through his intellect, and not like he understood and identified with what he was saying. It just came out like a talking donkey. That's part of the lapoon of him, according to the rabbinical approach.
I don't agree with that. For what you were reading, if we go through that sentence, he says, "May I speak what I really want to say?" Because this guy's the king, and he's asking him, can I speak my real opinion? Or do I just have to say what you, the king, want me to say? Because most kings will kill the guy who doesn't say what they want to say. So it's me and you, Balak, can I say it? And Balak basically, it sounds like he's got permission to do it. And he says, therefore, I'm going to tell you, in essence, I will speak the words of God, that they're blessed, basically. So he's telling the guy, if you want me to say something, as long as you're not going to kill me, I'm going to tell you.
Yeah, I don't see where he asks for permission.
It's
which verse does he ask for permission?
Yeah, absolutely. He says,
when he first gets there.
Verse 38 you're looking at?
It's 38. And Balaam said to Balaam, now that I have come to you, have I
any power to say.
Oh, I see how you're reading it. Oh, but you don't have to read it like that. It's not that he's asking permission. He's saying, do I have the power to speak freely? Of course not. I can only speak what God tells me.
No. He's asking the king.
No, he's not.
He tells him. Yes, he says to him.
Okay, so you're very original.
He says to Balak, do I have the power to speak freely? Balak's the king. He's about to tell him.
He's telling the king, have I the power to speak freely? Of course I don't. Only what God puts in my mouth. Look at the rest of the sentence. I can only utter the word that God puts in my mouth. It's not that he's asking the king permission. He's rhetorically saying, do I have permission to speak what I want? Of course I don't. I can only speak what God puts in my mouth.
Hmm. No, he says,
yeah.
Balaam says to Balak, lo, I am come to thee. Have I now any power at all to say anything? Mm-hmm. That's what he's asked the king.
And what's the next words?
The words that God puts in my mouth, that I shall speak.
Yeah.
He's telling him in advance he's not going to say what you want me to say. You're the king. These guys kill you if you don't do exactly what
you're right,
what
but he's not asking for permission. He's saying that I cannot speak anything but what God puts on my mouth.
No, first he's telling him...
okay, right. We have an argument. I understand what you're saying. I think you have a very ingenious interpretation. Let me just see if it fits in the Hebrew what you're saying. In verse 38?
It says right there.
What you're saying could fit into the Hebrew. I don't think it fits into the context of what comes later. But anyway, so we ended with a teku, which is a tie, I would say. And we see the problematics of these verses. And I actually have struggled with this for decades. I think it's an
the
open
Hebrew
question.
The Hebrew doesn't have a question mark. That's where it's misleading.
But it's in the ha'onam, the hey, yeah, the beginning, does indicate a question. Ha means is it that? It's a question. Uh-huh. Hey of the question. So it is like a question mark. Uh-huh. But that still doesn't prove who's right here.
A lot of people. Okay, can I? You're a rabbi. Can I speak freely to you before you tell someone your opinion? Right.
I understand especially what you're saying, Fred. You but I'm just saying that I have always read it differently, and I just heard a new interpretation. So okay, very good. I want to take a minute at the end to make two announcements.